This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, and streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me tonight is Richard Hawes.
Hello, everybody.
And Stephen Lockeridge.
Hello.
And we have Ross Byask, director of I Am Vengeance 2, Retaliation.
Hello.
Awesome. And let's kick straight off. So with I Am Vengeance 2 being released in the next few weeks in the UK, Ross has kindly joined us to have a little chat about the film. So this is the second time I had a chance to watch it because you kindly invited me along to your first screening last year. So Rich, have you got any questions lined up?
My first question is the title. Now, am I right thinking that in the UK it's not Vengeance 2, it's going to be I Am Vengeance Retaliation?
Yes. For anyone who doesn't know, the original film in the UK and many other territories was Vengeance. Our awesome American, or I should say North American distributors, Saban Films, with Lionsgate, retitled the first film I Am Vengeance for their territory. And subsequently, a few other territories obviously changed the title as well. Japan has a fascinating title and so forth. So when it came to the sequel, while we were making it, we obviously called it Vengeance 2 for our own purposes. And during post, talking with Saban and Lionsgate, they essentially put forward the title I Am Vengeance Retaliation. I'm sure there'll be some territories that call it I Am Vengeance 2, there'll be some territories that call it Vengeance 2. Because we worked so closely with Saban on the film, we've chosen to call it I Am Vengeance Retaliation as well, partly to stay in line with branding and marketing, which sounds kind of boring. But also, this movie, you do not have to have seen the first Vengeance film to understand it. If you have seen it, then it helps that you know the character of John Gold and, dare I say, Frost, although Mark Griffin, the actor who plays Frost, looks very different in the second movie. Yes. But they are the only two people who kind of carry over. And we made sure, really, during the development of it, that you didn't really need to have seen the first movie. So the title change, while perhaps incongruous to people who do know about the first one, for the majority of people who perhaps aren't aware of it, it won't affect, what they think of the film.
Cool. How was it working with Stu Bennett for a second time?
It was a sincere and continuing pleasure. Stu is, I think for anyone who knows Stu's background as a wrestling with the WWE, he was a superstar, and he under certain names like Wade Barrett, and of course Bad News Barrett and a number of other names. And so he's a very imposing figure. He knows how to use his size and all of that stuff to be very imposing. But he's also, much like a lot of the other wrestlers I've met, super down to earth, super humble, very modest, very talented, very hardworking and enthusiastic. So obviously when we worked together the first time, I really enjoyed the experience, and we'd stayed in touch subsequently and talked about the sequel potentially and other projects and so forth, and just been a really good person just to stay in touch with. On the second movie, there's a few things. First of all, he's so much more grown into, if you like, his look as a man, if that makes sense. As an action star, he holds himself in a more developed way in terms of film acting, if I can call it that, but also in terms of his personality and his commitment and his integrity to the character. That was fantastic. We had a great conversations before filming, of course, talking about the character and how we were going to bring more of his personality out. So sort of working with him on that and working with him on the shoot again was fantastic. It was so great to see how he's developed as an actor in the intervening years. For those who don't know, he's done some other movies, like Fanged Up, and he's done a lot of presenting as well in the meantime. So, his if you like, his screen persona has developed even further. So it was an absolute pleasure. That was my short version of the answer.
Was there any issues? Obviously, the second film is a lot more of an ensemble cast rather, you know, with the team coming, helping him and stuff like that. Any issues with that at all, or was he quite open to that? Or?
Oh, no, he was very open to that, because one of the things we liked about the team, or certainly one of the reasons behind the writing of that, and Stu certainly got on board with it, was that because he's able to sort of bounce off those team members, including Frost as well, and then also team played by Vinnie Jones, we get a lot more of his character than in the first movie. We don't go into too much depth, because, you know, there's going to be another one. You know, we want to leave something for future installments. But you do see him lighten up as he sort of bounces off of Lynch and Shapiro, Phoebe Robinson-Gavin and Sam Benjamin, and to an extent in his scenes with Frost. Mm. And, of course, his scenes with Vinnie Jones. You sort of get a bit more of his personality, the backstory, and through the movie he essentially warms up somewhat from being just this badass.
One of the things I really like about this is the fact that the team, as they are competent, you know,
right?
And they are an actual team rather than, you know, there's no infighting. I mean, I don't know if you've seen any of these are they called Modern Warfare films, Rich? What are they called?
Rogue Warfare.
Trilogy. Oh, isn't it? Has a second one just come out? Or am I getting that confused?
I think all three are out now.
Okay.
I think the second one just came on Netflix.
Yeah.
But is it Will? I think it still stars Will Young.
Anyway, the thing about those films is that they take all these guys from different parts of the military, put them together, and of course they all want to be sort of alpha males and fight each other rather than the enemy. Mm. And it's tedious, you know. Whereas something like Operation Red Sea, Dante Land's film, you know, you had a team which actually was a team acting together. And that's what we got here in your film. Even when Shapiro sort of like snarks off at the beginning, he says, I wonder how many people he's killed this week. And he just goes, 5. But he just takes it on the chin and goes, yeah, fair enough, mate. You know, shakes hands.
That was kind of the point. I mean, it was one of those, I do agree. One of the things I don't like, and, you know, I think I have to use my words a bit carefully, is I don't like films about people who are bad at their jobs. Mm. Unless that's part of the point. Like, unless that's the point.
Yeah.
If that's the point, if that's a story thing, fine. But when you see movies about, dare I say, professional robbers or professional soldiers, whatever you want to call it, particularly in those sorts of people. Now, obviously, with our films, we're talking about kind of elevated reality. We're not looking too deeply into the detail, you know. But overall, I don't like it when, like you say, a team of professionals just mess with each other. Like getting each other's way. I mean, obviously, they can bullshit with each other, you know, our team kind of, you know, like you say, we snark off and whatever. Mm. But when it comes to actually doing the job, overall, they're fairly competent. Like, things go wrong here and there, obviously, otherwise there'd be no story.
What you don't get is some idiot sort of turning, you know, getting an order and sort of going, who put you in charge? That sort of crap.
One of the things we steered away from were things like questioning chains of command or whatever you want to call it. Like, I think people pretty much go through what they're supposed to do largely, you know. And there are films that I've seen totally not naming names where you sort of see they're a badass team of professional robbers or whatever, and then they just everything they do just messes up what they're doing, and it's super avoidable. You always get like the wild card character or something. That's cool. Like, to me, that works, you know. But anyway, without getting too much into stories here. No, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. It is something that when I see it in movies, it does drive me a bit crazy, because you kind of go, is there time for this?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you see people messing each other up, is there time?
Yeah. It's like I watched Hunter Killer with my dad, you know, the Gerard Butler one.
Want to see that. It's got Shouty Oldman's in it, right?
It is a fun film. It really is. Cool. But all the way through, the XO, you know, is just questioning orders all the time. You know, this is madness. Why are we doing this sort of thing? And thinking, in reality, it'd be like, security officer, just take this guy down to the brig. You know,
right. Also, when someone says it enough, like, this is crazy, why are you doing it? Eventually, the audience says it.
Mm.
because if a film keeps telling you that again, unless it's a story point.
Yeah.
You know, like if you look at Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
That interaction, that, if you like, conflict comes from an actual, like a source where you would understand that they're arguing about it. Mm-hmm. If, you know, the part message and all of that. Mm-hmm. And all of the friction that then happens after that is understandable and built off that, yeah, it kind of builds that tension.
Mm.
That makes sense. But if it's in a situation where essentially, yeah, they're supposed to be like a well-oiled machine and someone just keeps saying, this is crazy, eventually your audience are going to go, yeah, why is anyone listening to this guy?
Yeah. Back to your film, anyway. So, in part one, we had a brilliant villain with Gary... I nearly said Gary Oldman then. Gary Daniels, in one of his best performances for a long time. And now you've got Mr. Vinnie Jones, no less, who... He's a very prolific actor these days. Ever since his role in Lock, Stock, and then he, you know, went across and did Gone in 60 Seconds from Bruckheimer. You know, he's been very prolific. He's been all over the place, and he does seem to sort of throw himself into his roles.
Very much. I mean, he also, I mean, just before coming to us, Vinny had just been on Arrow.
All right.
Which I love as a TV show. Yeah. And he'd just coincidentally been working with, I believe it was Cody Rhodes in that show, who is a very good friend of Stu's.
All right.
So when he told him what he was doing, Cody apparently was very enthusiastic about Stu, you know, and so forth. And that just led, obviously, to a fairly good first meeting between Stu and Vinny. Obviously, that helps. Because Vinny's very, you know, very experienced, a real veteran. So, you know, he'll understandably want to, you know, get a good grip of who's involved with the film. And so, I mean, I had a long chat with Vinny before he came to shoot. We discussed the character and the look and, you know, and everything about that. And it was terrific working with him. He delivers really well on screen. He's in, unlike a lot of, well, I shouldn't say this, unlike a number of films that he's in, he's not just a cameo. He is the main villain, and he was with us for like nearly 3 weeks of shooting.
That's cool.
So it was a real journey working with Vinny. And, not just in terms of just the dramatic side of things. Obviously, there was the action side of things. He is doubled, like, you know, he is, you know, by a terrific Brighton-based stuntman, Aaron DeStreet. I'll always give him a shout out because he was so brilliant and came aboard and worked so hard. But when Vinny is given the action to do, the action that he does, he sees it, nails it, moves on. Like, he's a proper professional and gets on with it. And he does what I call throwing with intent. Like, when he throws a punch, he looks like he wants to kill you, you know. So maybe he did. I don't know.
And it's so important that he does some of that, you know, because it does help sell the stunt doubles bit as well, I think. Because if it kept cutting to, like, the stunt double's leg or something during the kick, you know, you'd know. But, you know, when you actually see him sort of grappling with Stuart and stuff like that, and, as you say, throwing the punches in and getting a few blocks in and things, it does sort of help. Sort of build the physicality of the character.
Yeah, I mean, and look, we all know he's a physical guy anyway. And when casting this role, you know, the lead villain, we really needed someone who could stand up to Stu physically, and of course be a veteran, someone who could really show he's been through the wars and so forth, and someone who could believably build a backstory with Stu. Vinny brings that wealth of experience with him. Like, you know, one of my favourite things about filming was genuinely when we would run a scene, we would do the first take, and you could see Vinny thinking it over between the takes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would do take two, and he would have made some very specific decisions, choices between the takes. He wouldn't wildly vary. It wasn't anything like that, but it was more like he would give you more of a specific reaction on certain things, or he would look at a specific character and engage with them more. Like, he'd kind of process how the scene had gone.
Yeah,
and then he would do it again, and that was always really interesting to me. And there'd be a significant difference in terms of what he was doing, just in terms of how he was behaving within a take. And then if we did a third take again, he would make some smaller adjustments. And it was as a filmmaker, you know, as a director, and dare I say, the writer as well, seeing what he was doing with that was genuinely fascinating and really valuable for me.
Mm. Now, you have a third star in this one. In Katrina Durden, who is absolutely amazing in this film.
Yes, this is very true.
I cannot emphasize this enough. I mean, you know, you have two big guys fighting which is great. But, you know, the finesse comes from Katrina and the girl playing... help me out here. I can't remember.
It's okay. It's Phoebe Robinson-Galvin playing Lynch. Yeah.
That's it, Lynch.
Yeah. And their fights, I mean, their fights, a number of reviews have said it, their fights are something of a highlight of the movie.
Hmm. They steal the movie as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, definitely.
I just have to mention to you guys, axe kick, and I'm sure you know exactly what scene I mean.
I remember
seeing it last, you know, in Soho last year, and that axe kick got a real reaction from the audience. You know,
it did. I actually remember that quite specifically. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's gonna play well. That's good. I'm really proud of that. Actually, I mean, I'm proud of the whole thing, obviously, and I'm really having worked with Katrina and Phoebe, and they worked. Look, you've seen the film. They worked unbelievably hard. Absolutely. Like the hours they put in were just like. I'm aware that as a director, I don't even know. If you think about a cast and crew of a movie, I see something like probably between 5% and 10% of the actual work. Right. In the end, that's what I see. I don't see the hours that they prepare and the work that they do to get into it. I don't get to see many of the action rehearsals that Tim put together with them. I saw some of it, but very little of it because we're doing everything else, you know. So every department and every cast member, the work they put in is phenomenal. And when you see them, when you see Phoebe and Katrina together, what they do together, I feel like you just don't see this very often anymore. This kind of thing.
There are some brilliant little moments in that, because a lot of it is, you know, they're taking on guys almost twice their size, you know, as well. There are some very good fights in that film. Now, the choreography is done by Tim Mann, who is an absolute superstar in the world of fight choreography. Obviously, people would have seen his work in the likes of Accident Man, for one. Did he do Ninja 2?
Ninja 2, yes, absolutely.
That's what I thought, yeah. He's absolutely superb. So it's one of those things, when you see his name come up in the credits, you suddenly go, oh, good. You know, you settle in because you know you're going to get some decent fights, if nothing else.
Oh, and as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, I have a proper man crush on him. Like when I first realised we were going to be able to have a conversation, I was like, oh my goodness, okay. but the choreographer on the first movie did a great job. Like, Andre's fantastic, loved working with him. Of course, he wasn't available, and then, you know, we all had a conversation about who we would like to bring on board, and yeah, when I got a chance to speak to Tim, I was like, this is going to be amazing. He prevised everything so quickly because we had so little time. He didn't previs every fight, but he previs a significant number of them with his team, which obviously really helped on set, helped in choreographing, helped showing the cinematographer, Simon Mowling, you know, what we're going to be trying to achieve here, and so forth. The way he worked with the different departments as well, with like production design as well, and obviously the camera guys, and of course the cast was fantastic. I really wish I'd had more time just to watch him working with the performers.
So just because talking about how fantastic everyone is and how everything is, what sort of challenges did you face getting this underway and actually filming it? Any roadblocks hit you along the way?
Well, the biggest challenge, and this is probably going to sound really obvious for anyone who knows the process, but the biggest challenge is always just time every day. But, you know, we had to, in the end, drop a few things through there, which I will sincerely regret, just in terms of, because I'm also the editor, so I know what we need. So, having had to drop not many things, by the way, like a few things maximum, that was very frustrating. You know, it just was in the end. And you just have to go, right, we're going to figure this out. Carry on. You have to carry on, you know. And in the end, I think the film works. But there are a few things that I look at and go, if only we'd have shot this thing that I wanted, that would have taken 10 minutes. You know, like, you can't help but have that. So you always want more time. The only day that was like a real problem, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, was our very final day of filming, where we were actually filming the opening sequence.
All right.
And which came out fine in the end. I think I'm very happy, and I think hopefully everybody else is. But the first thing that happened on that day was our B camera died immediately. Like, we didn't get to use it at all. And if you've watched the film, there's shooting stuff, which takes a while to prepare. There's fighting. There's so many characters in it. So it really significantly slowed us down on that last day. And we had to drop a couple of things on that day, but we actually had some actors who came down to do a couple of small scenes, which we ended up not being able to film because of that.
That's a shame.
We had to literally drop a couple of pieces. It really was, they were really understanding and brilliant about it. They'd been there all day, and I was so grateful that they were okay, because I would have understood it if they'd been more upset. But that was nobody's fault. That's just something that happens. It was a shame because it was the last day particularly. But as a silver lining, the very last thing that we filmed was the conversation that Stu and Mark Griffin have outside the club when he recruits him for this mission. And it was sort of wonderful having the only two actors returning from the first film on a personal level.
Yeah.
And that scene went incredibly well. So, you know what I mean? Yeah. We pulled it out of the bag on that.
It's interesting that, you know, the fact that it is the last bit of filming, and yet it is actually, as you say, it's the start of the film. So they have to project a certain amount of freshness, you know, so, you know,
yes,
as if it was like first day of filming, you know, because it's the first scene. Yeah. So here you are as director, editor and writer for this film.
Did
the three hats ever have like a bit of a bust up, and you know, how disciplined were you in develop, you know, putting how, sorry, get my words right, how you know what I'm trying to say, Ross? It's like,
yes, I think I do.
How judicious were you in this? Because I've seen examples. I won't name the film, but there's one particular film out at the moment which is 2.5 hours long. It needed to be like a 90-minute film, and it was down to the fact that the director was also the writer. You know, and I'm thinking, you know, that's the way it came across. It's like he couldn't sacrifice anything he'd written.
So you know. I can significantly attribute this to my producers and business partners, John Adams and Diane Shorthouse.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously they produced the first film as well. And obviously, for anyone who doesn't know, Evolutionary Films, our company, we're also the sales agent and UK distributor for the films as well. So we have a vested business interest in making this film as commercially viable as possible, it can be sort of a subjective opinion, I think. Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying in terms of how. Okay, so there's that old phrase, no sacred cows, don't, you know, that kind of thing. So was it kill your darlings or whatever it is? And so the first thing is, as an editor, I've always been like, cut as much out as possible. Like William Goldman said it best, get into, and this is as a writer, get into the scene as late as possible and leave as soon as you can. I think if the film probably could have been 60 minutes long, you know, maybe not given the content now, I don't know. But so as a writer, it's all about, for me, it's always been about how economically can you write? Like, don't try not to get too flowery, because inevitably it all goes when you're filming anyway. So I always get great notes from John and Diana. That's, you know, during the writing process, that's during the editing process for sure. Obviously on the set, they're keeping everything running and constantly monitoring what we're doing. You know? In fact, there was a scene where we had to do a sort of a small amount of reshoots for one of the scenes in the epilogue. And we had to very carefully, you know, allocate some time to do that one night when we had the right people. And it was all about, what do we need to make the scene work? It wasn't like, let's reshoot the scene. It was, we need a close-up of this person and we need these lines. You know what I mean? It was very... And that was the action plan, and being really careful. We also had a situation with an actor who had to depart the shoot much earlier than initially anticipated. And John himself came up with an idea of how to clear that character out, who was kind of already in the middle of the movie. And it was John's idea thoroughly how to sort it out. And it actually added very much to sort of the weight of it. I'm sure we'll talk about it another time. but what happened. But it was John overall that really came up with that. And obviously I then wrote that with him, if you see what I mean, to make it actually work. But like, it was a very, very kind of almost like a delicate situation, which if we hadn't addressed it as soon as possible, it'd have all gone wrong. And it was absolutely from the producers that made that work. So I'm very lucky and fortunate to be working with them, because they give great guidance. We don't always agree on everything, because why would we? But in terms of keeping things on track and moving forward, they're essential. So So that's very much part of the script writing process as well, because obviously I rely on their notes. We obviously do a read through with actors as well, and you know, you always benefit from that too. Mm-hmm. And so in many ways, for screenplays, I always try to be economical as a writer. When we're shooting, it's all about making your day. So as a director, what I try to be is unfussy, if that makes sense. I know what I want.
Yeah.
I know what I want, but also you have this many hours. It takes about 10 minutes at least to change the setup of the camera. So every time you want to add something, you've got to then add however many setups. You know, it's things like that. You've got to be economical with your time. You've got to keep moving forward, and you've got to deliver your day. Hmm. So
how long
that's
were
your
days?
For the life of me, I don't remember. It was probably 10 or 11 hours.
Jeez.
Something like that. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, because it's all about keeping everybody fresh and comfortable and as rested as possible and so forth. And everybody committed so hard. Everyone worked so hard. So, you know, there's only so much time you've got at all. So, I don't get to be Kubrick. I wouldn't want to be, but I don't get to be, let's have 9 takes. If you're having to do 4 or 5 takes of anything,
yeah,
you sort of end up going, well, what do we change? Because this isn't working.
Mm.
You know, what can we... So it's when you're shooting, as much as you sort of want to be the pained artiste, right? Because everybody wants to be. Like, our cinematographer wants to deliver as hard as possible. Simon was always going, you know, as stylish as possible, but economically so, you know, and all of that. So everyone's trying to push really hard to deliver. As a director, you can't be standing there going, well, I'd like to do this really fancy, just deliver your day. You know, there are some things you'd love to get more creative with. Maybe later on I can do that. For me, it's actually about delivering the movie, always. So you try to find the best way to bring that out of everybody. And then there are, let's say, in the editing process, and then obviously the post of sound and grading the picture and VFX and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You try to make everything tell the story. I'm sorry, I'm probably rambling too much.
That's all right.
But everything should be great. Yeah, you can edit me out. It's perfect.
You know, there you are, directing the film. You've got so many days to actually shoot it. Then you're moving into your editing suite, or suppose there's other steps involved as well. How much of a control do you have? Are you overarching everything that's going on, or you know, do you have different departments that you sort of have people working?
In the end I cut it, and then again I get obviously good notes from John and Diane and anyone else we decide to bring into it, for various reasons. You might need specific opinion VFX or something.
Mm-hmm.
We work with an amazing company called Filmgate, run by Sean Whelan, who's fantastic. But it's all about that process. It's about whittling it down and honing it and trying to refine it as far as possible. That's myself. And again, like I say, that's from Ben and Dan. And then when it comes to things like grading, obviously, we work with an amazing company called Filmshed, Pat Wintersgill. I recommend them hugely. And we worked with Pinewood Sound. We did our sound at Pinewood, which was an amazing experience as well. And of course, they sort of do the sound and Filmshed do the grade. But of course I give notes, and of course I go in and sort of supervise certain sessions.
Yeah.
And then again, of course, the producers come in as well, too. John and Dave come in on all of that as well. But sort of nearer the end to approve, because there's only so much time. You know, and also it's good to have fresh eyes and fresh ears. It's important not to have everybody tangled up in the process. So I don't sit at the sound, like in the sound booth every single time, because I've just been sort of sitting over someone's shoulder. There's no point.
Micromanaging, basically.
No, and I think the secret to that, I think, is working with people who are better than you. They're people who know more than you, so benefit from their experience. It's the same as the crew. It's the same as the car. Get people, like, surround yourself with people who you can try and elevate your game to meet.
Yeah.
People who know what they're doing, so you can
absolutely go along with you them. Again, you don't have to agree with everything anyone says. You know, and again, you have your own vision and what you want to, you know, what you want to see and hear. But when you're working with the people who do things like Angel Has Fallen, you know what I mean? Like they played me a gunfight. When I first went in to meet the team, they showed me one of the sequences from Angel Has Fallen, and it's sort of an early stage. And he was like, do you want the gunshots like that? And I was like, yes, please.
yes.
Yes, please. So, and of course you get passes on the sound, and you make notes on the passes, and you say, oh, I'd like this neck break to be chunkier, you know, wetter or something. There's all of that too. There's all of that too. And that's fun. When you get to sort of do things like that, that's, you know, very entertaining.
Cool. One person we haven't mentioned yet in front of the screen, and that is Jean-Paul Lee, who's an actor that both me and Rich are very sort of fans of. How did you manage to get him roped into this?
I mean, we've known each other for a while now. I am a huge fan of JP. Like, I love Jailbreak. Love Night Shooters.
Yeah.
And also his short film, is it The Division, if I remember correctly. And he's such an enthusiastic, warm human being. He's like the nicest, and again, humble. There doesn't appear to be any ego in there, which is incredible. And watching his fight, without giving too spoiler, his fight that he has in the end fight sequence, because there's about five fights going on at the same time. Watching that go down with Tim choreographing and Greg Burridge as his opponent, there was something quite special about that fight. It's savage. Mm. It's savage. They both look amazing. Simon really captured it brilliantly as a cinematographer. And yeah, when we filmed it, we had very little time, but they really nailed it. They nailed it every take. So it was a pleasure. You know, it was a pleasure working with JP. I'd love to work with him again more extensively.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so. more John Paul, less for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Guys, any more questions for us?
I was wondering. I mean, I'm presuming that with Saban involved, it was a bigger budget for the second one.
It was not gigantically, but we were very lucky to benefit from a bigger budget, which allowed for, dare I say, more cast and certainly someone like Vinny, and the amount of production value, you know, in terms of the amount of action and the SFX. We worked with this incredible team, Armory FX, who are incredible special effects and armory and pyrotechnics. Amazing.
Yeah.
They do so many great movies. So, and again, we're very lucky to be friends with them. And, you know, they came in and really kill it, you know.
I read a review the other day. I think it said, you know, if you give Ross Byers 15,000, he'll make it look like it costs 25 million.
Thanks. And that's not like, just me. It's not just me. There's a lot of people involved.
Exactly. But, you know, I thought... It's a good point there, because it looks fantastic, I'll be honest with you, you know, the way you've shot it, everything, I really, really enjoyed it. I just thought it was great. Another thing as well, Mike, we've also got one of our old Smoking Lamp alumni in there as well, haven't we?
Mr. David Shaw.
Yes, he's in it as well.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. Yeah. He is so great to work with. I was actually given him as like a list of options to play that role from the same agency. Yeah. And I was like, David Shaw, how do I get to that? Can we get David Shaw? And when he was there, I was a little bit like, I can't believe he's here. I know that sounds, he's a great actor. And he's a working actor. I've seen him in so many things through the years. And he just came in and just nailed. We had a very small chat. Not a lot. We had a small chat. And he just delivered immediately. It's great.
It was a very good performance. You know, I've seen other actors like, you know, sort of Tim Pigott Smith sort of you know, chew the scenery with that sort of role, you know. Like in the MI5 movie, movie and things like that, he came across thinking, I could see him being a minister, no problem.
He's great. Loved working with him. I wish we had more of him in general, but he just comes in and nails it. He kind of came in, nailed it, was wonderful, and then said, cheers. but he's brilliant on social media. He, you know, we've stayed in touch here and there, and he's a delight. I feel really weird. I feel like I want to talk about everyone was amazing. But everyone was amazing. Like, the team were amazing to work. I would work with everybody again in a heartbeat. I really would.
I was just wanting to sort of pick up on what Steve was saying about how the film just looks great. I mean, the martial arts action is top class and looks amazing. Mm. But more so than, you know, we've kind of, what I wanted to say was the film itself, in the way it's shot and the grading and everything, makes it look much bigger than obviously probably the budget probably was. I mean, we see quite a lot of low budget action films. I just think it looks fantastic. And part of that was the locations, because I thought they were really striking industrial sort of rural locations. I wonder, you know, where you found those places, what they actually were originally before they became abandoned and derelict and stuff. There's some striking architecture.
Yeah, it's funny because aside from The Very Last Day, which we filmed in Basildon, in the Gentleman's Club in Basildon, who were very nice to us. It is very nice. But the rest of it was filmed in a place called RAF Bentwaters in Suffolk.
Right, okay.
And it's an air base that's also a museum, if I recall correctly. So they have a variety of hangars and bunkers. And in fact, once you film there, you see it in everything. Angel Has Fallen was filmed there. Mm. But there's loads of stuff. There are bits of it that you just go, I know where that is. you start to see, a bit like when we filmed in a place called Brickett Wood for the first movie, and that's in Accident Man, and it's in like Tracy Ullman. And like, every time you watch stuff now, I go, I know exactly where that is in Brickett Wood. It's really funny. And while we were there, like four or five different productions rolled in and out. So seriously, like while we were there, and that's on the first movie. But yeah, on Bentwaters, yeah, it was incredible. Though again, staff were super helpful, really lovely. The locations are quite iconic, and again, keep an eye out when you watch stuff. You will see it in a lot of movies. So yeah, it was fantastic for the production team to be able to get in there, and production design team, I should say, to get in there. And, I mean, the staging area they made for the team, you know, for their briefing and everything. When I walked in there for the first time, I was like, "What is this? How is this real? Like, I don't understand." It was like walking into Sicario or something. Like it was ridiculous. Paul Burns, the production manager, just amazing.
Another thing I wanted to ask was, at what point did you decide, you know, we've got to take this guy's lines and we've got to make a Barry White song out of it?
That's amazing. That's really funny. You're the first person. You would not believe how many interviews I've done, like for America, actually. And nobody has actually brought that up yet.
Crazy, because it's great.
You know, so the actor Bentley Kalu, who is actually a singer, and he's been in loads of it. He was in like Ultron. He's been in tons of stuff. Plays the bad guy called Renner. He's so much fun to work with. Such great, again, great, really warm person. Really, really effusive and enthusiastic and stuff. Our DIT, for people who don't know, that's the chap who takes the footage and kind of like lines it up in an editing program, syncs up the sound and all of that stuff. It's Ryan Lee, who's a lovely, lovely fellow. And he did a couple of things during the shoot. He took the sound bites from Bentley and found literally a Barry White song, just the instrumental, and started playing with it. I didn't know anything about this at all until like it was the end of one of the day. I don't remember. It was sort of probably halfway through the shoot. I went in, he was like, Jordan, I need to show you something. And I was like, what? And he played it. And it's not quite what you hear on the end credits, but it's a very similar, you know, it's an actual Barry White song. Mm-hmm. And I fell over. I was laughing so hard. And then I think he showed Bentley himself. I think he showed a couple of people, and Bentley loved it. Thank God, because that could have gone very badly wrong. And we basically sought Bentley's permission. This came really late in the process to actually put it into the film. It came really late, like literally we were mixing the sound. And we said to Bentley, would you mind at the end of the film if we did that? And he was like, go for it, it's great. And so the composer, Thomas Gallagher, very quickly did a mix. He literally did it in a couple of hours or something. He came up with like a Barry White riff, you know, similar riff. And then laid it down and then sent it straight through to the UK and they added it. Like, it was an unbelievably quick process to do that. And I think it's really funny. Really chuffed. And hopefully...
And it's also a great little bonus for those of you, who stick around for the credits. Because some people just turn off straight away.
Yeah, some people turn off a moment right to the UK. But hopefully it's just, like, hopefully it's a bit of a bonus for, like, people understanding we're not taking ourselves too seriously. Like, it's a goofy, I mean it in the best way, like an elevated action movie.
I think the boxer shorts do the job of that.
That's a story unto itself. If anyone who needs to look really, anyone who wants to look really closely at those boxer shorts, the design, because they're red, is dinosaurs wearing shades. And the dichotomy of that alone, for me, I just wish we could have gotten closer, not to sound too interested in Sam Benjamin's wonderful nethers. I really wish we could have, like, filled the screen a little bit more with, like, the dinosaurs with shades. We just couldn't get that close with the lenses. Which
wasn't,
is probably
wasn't
a burst.
So much,
probably
wasn't
a
so much the boxers as the socks with suspenders that sort of threw me. Really.
Oh, thank you. They were a detail that was actually in the script, if you can believe it.
Bizarre.
It was actually in the script. Heaven help us.
Any more for any more, guys? Otherwise, we're going to wrap this up.
I just wanted to, I mean, we can sort of evaluate from our own experience what we think your influences were on this film. Mm. I just wanted to sort of hear it from the horse's mouth. Sort of, I think the first one, you know, being a hardcore Commando fan, you were very much sort of channeling that into your first film. And this one, you've gone in a different direction. What films were you thinking of?
I mean, weirdly, I mean, in the first film, there was that kind of intent, was sort of, get Carter meets Commando, basically. I mean, for a short measure. In this one, it was slightly, this may sound like a negative, but it was almost more generic than that. It was more like things like SWAT. Do you remember the SWAT movie?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which I know sounds odd. Like, I wanted to find, it was, how do I explain this? So the main difference in the writing process, kind of, at least from the inception of the film, was that we wanted to do a couple of things. First of all, we wanted to expand on Gold's character. And then secondly, we wanted to go, in inverted commas, bigger and better as a sequel. And that would infer being more of an action movie and kind of a chase movie and a team movie. Those were kind of things that I just sort of brought in, right? They were just sort of, because a team helps Gold kind of like bounce off people more. The SWAT aspect is simply, there's a villain who they've got to escort somewhere, and there are people after them. Like I mean, SWAT is slightly different because there are people trying to rescue him for money. Like, he kind of like says, anyone who rescues me gets millions of dollars or something, right?
Right.
But it didn't do it very well as a film, I thought. But that's, you know, so it's fun. But so I kind of, this was more about bringing aspects of films rather than specific films.
Sure.
So it really was like classic team movies. Mm-hmm. As well as chase movies. So it was odd. I didn't really follow. When I kind of say Get Carter meets Commando, Get Carter, he kind of goes from place to place. Or you could even say Shaft, but I'm probably the wrong influence for me to say that. But, you know, he goes from place to place, getting information and, where necessary, killing his way to the top, kind of. And then the flip of that was kind of the Commando aspect of the siege at the end, like the bad guy siege at the end. And then obviously, I sort of seeded in like the idea of almost like a British Western. Like, there's all of that stuff in the first movie. Mm. The second one was much more of a sort of a straight line, deliver on the action. It sort of sounds weird. I don't want to sound like I wasn't inspired. I probably drew more from like loads of films and TV shows and comic books and everything, rather than like two, if you like, key sources.
Yeah. Would I be right in saying there's some a continuation of the Commando influence in, because the way I saw it, Vinnie Jones's character seemed to have shades of Vernon Wells's character in Commando.
Bennett. To a degree, simply because of like the past relationship, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. And also, I always like a movie villain who kind of enjoys himself. I appreciate actors do want to ground it. Like, I mean, I think Gary did an amazing job in the first film of kind of grounding him in some kind of reality. And I think Vinny does equally the same thing. Vinny's got huge charisma, but he was always trying to find ways to economize the dialogue and kind of keep it core, if that makes sense, rather than be flowery with it. Mm-hmm. Like Teague could have monologued a lot more, and there were certainly some sequences where he really whittled it down, but that was absolutely for the best. Like, I'm not precious. Like, if I was desperately concerned with keeping a particular line, then I would, you know, raise my voice or whatever, which happened maybe twice. Like, I'd say, we need to say this because, you know. But he was great at kind of getting to the essence of it. So for me, it was sort of more influences of the subgenres than individual movies.
Mm-hmm.
An intention of always moving everything forward. So it was like, what gets us forward to the next piece? And then, of course, actually, the other thing that was important was I still wanted revenge or vengeance as a theme. And but in this story, it's more about it's Jen Quaid's character who has the vengeance, like the lust for vengeance, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
So that was really important to incorporate into it for personal reasons, really. So it all kind of sprang from that. I hope that's not too muddy. It's definitely, yeah, it's much less sort of an idea of saying put these two films together, kind of. It was much more about genres of films and types of films and sort of finding the right tropes to kind of push forward.
Yeah.
I hope that makes some sort of sense.
Just one last one. Do you think you're going to make it round it up as a trilogy or any plans to?
Well, there are currently two scripts for Vengeance 3. And they could be Vengeance 3 and 4, kind of. They're both completely different stories, though. They're not... Again, they've both been written with the idea that you don't need to have seen the first two movies, although, again, there are connections. Yeah. There are characters that follow through without getting too detailed about it just yet. And that's the case for both scripts, but they are both completely different. So the short version is there's absolutely two possibilities for going to a third movie. And then the other script could, in theory, be part four, or it could almost be its own film. You know, you just change the title, the character names, if you like.
It
feels like there's unfinished business at the end of part two. Yeah, it feels like it's kind of not so much a cliffhanger, but more like, oh, he's about to go, Gold is about to go off now in kind of like a, almost with like a new lease on life. So there's all of that. And I like a number of the characters in the second film so much that they do bleed through into both of these scripts one way, and they do carry over into both of these scripts. So that's kind of exciting. And I'm really curious to see which way we can go, all being well, for the third one.
Let's have a Jen Quaid spin-off.
You're not the first person to ask that. I'm kind of going, interesting.
Yeah, I might need to have a word in your ear about that, Ross, at some point.
Oh, right, really?
Yes, really. I may have a good concept for you.
Oh, I see. I was like, what? the perils of Jen.
But definitely with someone like Katrina in mind.
Oh, I see. That's intriguing.
Yeah, I just want to say, do you remember when Tomorrow Never Dies came out and Michelle Yeoh was everyone was loving her and they were saying, oh, we're going to make a spin-off movie with her. That's exactly how I felt when I was watching this movie.
That's really exciting. No, she's had a lot of praise and rightly so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's really cool. And and I'm glad that's come across, you know, because, you know, these things can not always work out as one hopes they do.
Indeed.
So I'm really glad that she's come across well. To everyone.
Ross, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I'm sorry if I've rambled.
No, just remind us when I Am Vengeance 2 is coming out in the UK.
Yes, so in the UK, it's released on all the major platforms July the 13th, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And there'll be marketing and brand. You know, I'll start again. There'll be, you know, more commercials and adverts and clips and teasers and bits and pieces coming out soon. Can I talk about our social media and all of that?
Absolutely, yeah, plug away.
So for anyone who cares to stalk me, I'm at Ross Boyass on all the social things. At Evo Films UK is the social media for Evolutionary Films. Obviously, this is not our only film. We have other action titles coming out fairly soon, which is exciting too. I'm sure you'll probably be covering those, I would hope. And then, of course, there's at Vengeance Film UK, which is for social media for the Vengeance franchise. There's been some really exciting stuff. We even had today the WWE champ Drew McIntyre and Roman Reigns both tweeted about the film, which was really exciting. Yeah. That was amazing. And obviously it's the US release, but that's still fantastic. Like, blew my mind a little bit to see that. So, you know, anyone who wants to sort of tweet along and follow along and you know, hope, you know, we're quite interactive on social media. So please say hello.
Awesome. Okay, so yes, as the man says, the film is out on July 13th. Do check it out. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ross.
Thanks. Thank you so much, everybody. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So thanks for Ross for joining us this evening. And now we're going to crack on with our first review. We will also be doing our short shot, which is a film called The Cure. It's going to be really interesting talking about that later on. Our DTV throwback is US Seals 2 by Isaac Florentine. But right now we're going to get stuck into Ross's film, Iron Vengeance 2 Retaliation. So, in this one, former Special Forces soldier Gold is given the opportunity to bring Sean Teague, the man who betrayed his team on their final mission in Eastern Europe several years ago, to justice. But things don't go quite as planned. Okay, so this is a bigger, bustier sequel to Vengeance. It is. It's literally got busted. So, Rich, your thoughts first.
My thoughts? Well, as you probably gathered from the interview that we just did with Ross, I thought the film was great. There's so much to recommend it. Now, getting the sort of more negative stuff, not negative, but, you know, the less positive stuff out of the way first, is I'm not actually a fan of Stu Bennett and the John Gold character so much. So for me, the ensemble approach for this film actually worked really well, and having Vinnie Jones as that really strong villain, and the support cast of like Phoebe Robinson-Galvin and Katrina Durden specifically, real standouts. Getting Tim Mann in, making it much more of a martial arts action movie, with that high level of quality that you would expect from Tim Mann, you know. And all the performers, you know, it's really good. With a fantastic support cast of other people, by the way. So there's Greg Burridge, Lee Charles, Joe Egan, Bentley Kalu, we were just talking about the song that they got from his dialogue. He's got this great scene where he's confronting John Gold, and he's like, hang on a minute, this is a big moment for me, which I thought was brilliant. John Paul Lee and Josh Myers turns up at the beginning. Cast is amazing. So it looks great, even though it's a low-budget film. It's really solidly shot, great aesthetic to it, I would say. You know, it could look really cheap, but it just has that sheen, that quality look. And the martial arts and action scenes, you know, gunplay scenes and everything, brilliant. The sort of the only bit that I'm actually not particularly a fan of is Stu Bennett himself. So it's just a personal preference thing. I don't gel with the way he delivers his lines. Sounds more like somebody trying to sound gruff and hard, rather than I know that is how he sounds, but it just, for me, it just doesn't come across as strong as you would hope it would. So I really liked the first film, Vengeance, as well, but again, it was more to do with the supporting cast and the story rather than him himself. So I would be very much open to the Vengeance series going down a route which didn't rely so much on John Gold.
Sort of set in the same universe, but
yeah, that's just my personal view. I mean, we all warm to different action stars, right. And for me, I just don't particularly warm to him.
Yeah, I'd love to see a sort of strike back series, you know, a strike back style series with this sort of team of characters. Would be really cool. Steve, your thoughts on this?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I watched the first one earlier on in the week. Again, it was okay. I think the second one is such a step up, in terms of plot, in terms of story, like the ensemble cast, the action, the fight scenes are incredible, especially like you were saying, the Jen Quaid ones and Lynch, is it?
Yeah.
The Jen Quaid and Lynch fights were phenomenal. I think everyone's done a really good job on it. I mean, I kind of get where you're coming from, Richard, with John Gold, but I thought he suited the part really well. I didn't actually know who he was until I was watching the first one. And my youngest son walked in and went, "Isn't that Stu Bennett?" I'm like,
because he's a big wrestling fan, isn't he?
He used to be. I mean, he's 13 now, so he's gone off it, but he just walked in and went.
Well, if you like Stu, you should definitely see Eliminators with Scott Adkins. Yeah, because that was kind of the breakout one where it was like Stu. I mean, Stu was the bad guy in that, and Ross took him, and because he was, I think, in the wrestling world, he was the bad guy more than a heroic character, and so they tried to really sort of bend that anti-hero kind of quality about him. So it's been a really good transition. I think I might warm to him yet. We're only two films in. it's not quite there. But yeah, you're right. Everything else is everything else is top quality.
Yeah, it certainly has legs as a franchise, doesn't it? I mean, it's not something England has really done up till now. You know, is develop a character. You could say that. You know, you could say, yeah, let's build a franchise around this particular character or characters. You know, and I think you got this sort of larger than life character, larger than life actor. Let's face it, sort of playing this role, and there's a lot that can be done with it. That's for sure. Yeah, I did enjoy this. Go on.
No, so I was saying, I hope that what they don't do is if they do bring them back. Well, if they don't like put Teague in helping them, you know, like a
Fast and Furious.
Yeah, you know what I mean.
It could go that way. I will say, in terms of the story and the way the plot develops, although I do love the action and everything, there was a feeling for me of rinse and repeat. We were kind of going in over the same things in different combinations.
There's two things there. One, there's a whole sequence where they're trying to get the team are trying to apprehend Quaid. And it feels like the film stops while they're doing that. You know, that all the plot momentum just stops while, you know, we watch these guys rather ineptly try and sort that out.
I agree, it does, but it works for me. I mean, you know, one thing I think the sequel has got, it's much more humour in it compared to the first one. The first one was very straight-laced. There's no real hit apart from the slightly annoying...
couple of one-liners and stuff as well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and I just think it's a lot more flowing. I mean, the bit with Teague's fiance, I was literally on the floor laughing with that bit. but yeah, I just think overall, it's just the step up in quality. It's there on the screen to see the fight choreography. I thought was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think that's what was missing in the first one.
Yeah,
because there isn't, it's more.
That's the thing, because Stu Bennett's, you know, he's got a wrestling background, and it's very much sort of like, you know, sort of throwing haymakers at each other, isn't it? You know, that is style of stuff. You got Greg Burridge in there as one of the bad guys, who, you know, is got a wrestling background as well. We covered one of his films, London Rampage. Was it last year? I think it was last year. We know how good he can be as well. But you know, the finesse comes from the ladies, basically. You know, the high kicks, the jumping kicks, and all the rest of it. You know, that's where that's at. I mean, two of my favourite moves in the film. One is that aforementioned axe kick, which I thought was just brilliantly done. But there's another one, I think it's one that Katrina does, where she sort of launches herself into this guy's chest with a knee. So she wins him, then grabs hold of him, then just basically falls backwards and just pulls him like over the top of her. And it's just so well done. You know, he's doubling over as he's been kneed in the stomach. And she uses that momentum to sort of throw him over. I thought it was absolutely brilliant on screen. And it's a great way of showing, you know, these sort of diminutive women sort of fighting these sort of 6 foot built like shit, you know, shit brick house guys. No, this is you know, is a solid piece of work all round for sure. How are we going to score it?
I'm going to go. Yeah, I'm going to go a top end 7 out of 10 on this.
Mm-hmm. Steve,
I'm going to go an 8.
Okay, an 8. I'm going to join Rich on a 7, which isn't a bad mark at all. It's very entertaining. Definitely check it out when it comes out on the 13th of July. If you happen to be in America, you lucky bastards, you get to check it out earlier. But please do. And fellas, stay away from the downloads. You've been told. Our short shot this week is The Cure. Noah is a special forces mercenary type of guy who's hired to retrieve a cure for a disease which kills within 24 hours. There, that's better, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so this film is 36 minutes long, including credits. It is, they claim, this only cost $15,000 to make. Wow, if that is true.
With a crew of 3 people, I believe.
With a crew of 3 people, using lots and lots of CGI, but using it incredibly well, I have to say, because this looks like, you know, this could be the next Angel movie, you know, after Angel Has Fallen kind of thing. You know, the amount of carnage, gunfights, you know, fighter jets. It's amazing what they managed to put together in this film.
Yeah, I mean, it was good. Don't get me wrong, I enjoyed it, but it's more, to me, it seemed more like a stunt action. You know, what's the word I'm looking for?
It's almost like a proof of concept thing. It's not a fully. But they've got a slither of a story. And builds a huge action sequence around it, basically, is what they've done. But
just chase the MacGuffin.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we never actually see what's in the briefcase as in classic style. But I think, you know, for what they actually put on screen, you know, if they had a proper script, you know, which wasn't just a guy sat in a room sort of pointing people in the right direction to go get this guy. You know, if they had a fully developed script, I think they're definitely on the money.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely some talent involved. I mean, like I say, a lot of it is quite obviously CGI, but it looks good. I think there's only a couple of bits where it looked ropey, and that was with the fighter jet. Near the end. And
that reminded me so much. Yeah, that reminded me so much of Die Hard 4, that bit.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Apart from that, it was great.
Yeah, I was very impressed by this. I mean, when I first saw that it was 37 minutes long, I didn't expect it to be basically half an hour of that being a relentless action scene or a very closely knit together series of action scenes. I likened it to the Matrix Reloaded, where that part of the, you know, the freeway action scene or whatever, where it's one thing part, it's all connected, but it's a number of different things happening, but it's all put together as one massive sequence. And that was a lot like this on a much lower budget. It's got elements of, it doesn't look out of place compared to something like the Fast series, more like the more recent ones. You know, the vehicular action, they've got some nice fancy sports cars zooming around and plenty of, I mean, you could have a drinking game with the amount of cars that explode or flip over and stuff. So, you know, they reuse stuff. It doesn't matter. It's all part of the fun. And there's the whole, they do all these like tricks and stuff, like the guy they're pursuing, like leaning out of his car and firing his machine gun out of the door and stuff, you know, like a wanted kind of thing. But the hero of the movie, you know, there's one point where he's pursuing the cars, but he's running down the hill and he's doing like jumping and spinning and, you know, sliding down the hill, and it's all fast paced and the camera work is amazing. So that it delivers on pretty much every single action front. You know, you've got big sort of Michael Bay-ish kind of explosions, as CGI though they may all be, but pretty well done, really. Hand-to-hand and gunfights, and it all just doesn't let up. I mean, this is, for me, this is my favourite short of the year so far, in terms of what it delivers.
Yeah. You know what? These guys should be snapped up by The Asylum. Imagine how much better The Asylum movies would be for these guys doing the effects, you know.
Well, it makes you wonder how much they, how long they took on the film. I mean, it must have been a labour, really.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because I was remembering, do you remember we did cover that film, The Patriot, which was originally called Rising Fear?
Yeah.
Which was very low budget, but it had those aspirational big effects scenes in it.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, I was putting in mind a lot of that. It's the sheer ambition of it.
Yeah, I mean, it is so ambitious, but at the same time, you know, they've taken the care and attention to make it actually work. And did you see the credit sequence at the end, which had all these other sort of little clips in?
That kind of baffled me a bit, because I'm like, is this a sequel, or is it just showing, yeah, lads, this is what we can do. Let's take a look at this, you know. It was like, okay. It's what they've done is impressive. You can't grumble with that.
The only things I've got issues with is some of the editing is a bit too frenetic for its own good, especially during some of the car crash stuff. And I did say this to them. I said, well, you know, what was this, a case of trying to hide some of the effects work?
Yeah.
To have it quite so frenetic. They went, no. That was our stylistic choice. Thank you very much. And the other bit, which is, it's a trope which has been done to death, is the fate of the pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he knew exactly what was going to happen, you know, unfortunately.
So, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
I thought that was all handled quite well. You know, it's touching. There's nothing original about any of it, but I thought it handled it all very well. And like you say, that was one of the only things I didn't like about it was that sort of trailer or, you know, snippets of the rest of the story kind of thing, which does sort of back up the idea of was this a proof of concept? Are they, you know, trying to then secure the funding to make the rest of the story? So I wouldn't be surprised if eventually we got a much longer version, a bit like what they did with Blindside.
Yeah, exactly. Or Code 8.
Code 8, yeah.
As well.
I'll be honest. I mean, if they get it, then good on them. You know, they should be doing.
Absolutely. So it's a brilliant calling card for these guys. I think they're from Turkey, I believe.
Right, I couldn't really find out much information about them. I mean, it's only listed. I mean, when you go onto YouTube where I found it, the account it's on is just The Cure, the movie or something. And if you go on the IMDb, the director is Ahmet Atalay. And what's he got? He's got a few shorts and that he's done before, and he did another short called Mortal Nightmare, but you know, not really, there's not really much to tell us about them or whatever. It's not like, it's kind of, what's great really about this is it's really come out of nowhere. There's no one in this that we're familiar with or know from anything else.
Ahmet Atalay also plays Reaper in the film. He's the driver.
Right, okay.
And Masood Alam is Noah, our sort of parkour running sort of hero. So, yeah, brilliant, brilliant piece of work.
Yeah, definitely. Really, really great. I'm highly recommended. And
absolutely. So we'll be putting a link to this in the footnotes. So please check it out. It's 36 minutes long, a bit longer than some of the shorts we put up for you. But seriously, guys, for 15 grand, this is amazing work. Can you Our DTV throwback this week is US SEALs 2. A commando of retired US SEALs must invade an island in North Japan where a rogue ex-SEAL menaces to launch nuclear strike against the US. Because of a leak of natural gas, fighting is restricted to bladed weapons. So, this is directed by Isaac Florentine, someone we know very well for his films. This probably wasn't too long after his stint on Power Rangers, I think. And I'm basing that on the fact that it's still got those weird sort of sound effects to just about every movement. So anyone turns his head, you sort of hear a whew, and all this sort of stuff all the way through, which is quite amusing.
That's one way to put it.
I remember seeing this a few years ago, many years ago, in fact, and really, really enjoying it, even though it is incredibly silly. So, Rich, over to you.
Yeah, I think personally that this is one of the ultimate diamonds in the rough of because the film had the film was a sequel to a forgettable, forgettably bland, you know, Men on a Mission actioner. They never bothered to actually produce any proper artwork for it. It's never had, as far as I'm aware, any kind of special edition release, like, for example, like Drive had. And this is every bit as watchable, you know, and entertaining as Drive, in my view. It's really elevated with some fantastic fight choreography and well shot as well by choreographer, fight coordinator Andy Cheng, who went on to later direct, oddly, films like Endgame with Cuba Gooding Jr. and Redline. But this was a point when he was focusing on the fight choreography. He was a member of the stunt, Jackie Chan's stunt team. Isaac Florentine, who's a massive martial arts action film fan, brought him on board, and they just went to town with, you know, I'm guessing New Image probably said, yeah, you can do whatever you want. You know, it's just got to have, it's got to have Navy SEALs in it.
It's a tax break, isn't it?
Here's your money, go and do it. And they just made, they took lemons and they made, you know, sort of made lemonade kind of thing. And it's just really a fantastically entertaining action film with a brilliant cast. And it's one of, I think this when we were watching I Am Vengeance Retaliation, this was a film that I felt very much seemed like a touchstone or is similar in theme, because they're both about, you know, they're quite low budget, sparse locations, don't have any, you know, it's not about having extras and stuff. It's just about finding a place and shooting a load of action scenes really well. And the whole film just works. Oh, Assault on Devil's Island is another one, a TV movie from the 90s, which had Hulk Hogan and Shannon Tweed. Great, Carl Weathers as well. Great cast, not a good movie, but a great cast, and it's another sort of invading an island thing. Yeah. But I think there's just so much to recommend this movie, but not the the whipping, the whooshing sound effects thing, which is so irritating.
It's a weird choice. It's such a weird choice, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's there from the very beginning, so you know it's setting it up with, like, literally any movement.
Yeah.
Like, it's the worst. And that's such a shame, because that sort of really takes the edge off is what is otherwise incredibly. I mean, the action, you know, if you just fast forward through the rest of the scenes, just watch the action scenes, you're in for a treat.
They do such a good job of, you know, the MacGuffin of having this island. You know, it was a Russian nuclear facility or something, and this ended up being, you know, saturated with methane gas or something like this. Yeah. And so any spark is going to blow up the whole island.
Yeah. Unless you're fine to use swords.
Yeah, swords. Yeah. We just throw sparks everywhere. But it's interesting that, so the main bad guy, you know, is addicted to smoking cigars and he's always got one in his mouth. And I'm thinking, yeah, any moment there he's going to absent-mindedly light it. But he does sort of, yeah, he gets in one guy's face because they brought a gun with them. That was pretty good. You know, sort of sell the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is pretty good. His main henchman is played by Sophia Crawford, which I like as well.
Using her English accent, which is fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
She's most well known as being one of Buffy the Vampire Slayer's doubles.
She is, yeah. She also did a few films out in Hong Kong, and ran about the same time as Cynthia Rothrock as well. So, yeah, good on her. It's a great little film. It's definitely worth checking out. I managed to pick this up for £2.49 off Amazon. They've still got a few copies left, I think. It is, you know, it is a bargain basement release, but it, as Rich says, it is a diamond in the rough. Definitely.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be like rediscovered or something, you know, at some point, and there'll be a proper release for it, because it just seems absolute madness. There's a couple of, because it's got that Hong Kong influence, there's masses of crash zooms and stuff in it, which are quite fun. There's a couple of things with the budget that I wouldn't mention. There's the first part of the story or the early part is taking place in Japan, apparently. But I'm sure that when the scene happens with the villain, when it all goes Broken Arrow, you know, when the bad guy's standing in front of the fire and whatever, and the police turn up, I'm sure that's like an American police car rather than a Japanese police car. It's little weird things like that. But the whole island cannot have any spark or anything. Oh, but there's a massive missile, and the missile can take off without a problem. So,
you know what? I never even thought about that. If they were to launch their missile, they're going to blow up the whole fucking island, aren't they?
So basically, they copy the Broken Arrow influences in a couple of things. One of which is I think he does it in Under Siege 2, which the villain Damien Chappell was actually in as well as a supporting character, where they release they actually have two missiles, and they send one up just to prove that they mean business. I know this probably all goes back to James Bond films and stuff, I'm sure. But there's all that sort of, the cloud of methane, it only goes up to this level, the massive, you know, explosion from the bottom of the missile. It's not going to affect anything. But if you just park your brain at the door, hand it in, and just run with it, you'll have a great time. So the cast includes people like Daniel Southworth. Michael Worth is the lead. I think he's really strong. We don't see much of him these days. He's more of a film historian working on a project about Bruce exploitation movies and actually releasing them now on DVD. But this was kind of a period where he was one of the sort of go-to guys in B-movies and martial arts films. And I thought he's very charismatic, very strong. Karen Kim is his main cohort, and sort of love interest, really, although they don't have much of a relationship in that sense. But I think there's... What did you get from it?
I kind of got they sort of grew up together.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
They both trained under... he trained under her father, who's... Who was he? Because he was another great Mark actor.
George Chung.
Yeah, George Chung, yeah. So, Florentine put a great cast together. The film's got this structure where... they have to go back and they have to go and get the best because he's retired. And so they go and find Michael Worth, and he's like, I don't do that stuff anymore. And they're like, but it's Casey. And it's like, oh, he's got a score to settle. So he's got to come back now. And then he comes in and they go, well, I've got to assemble my own team. So we get an assembling the team bit where each of those sequences is a completely unnecessary action scene that's just, you know, very entertaining. So he has a showdown with one guy in a bar. There's one of those, when it turns out there's an action scene, but it actually turns out it's a drill. You know, it's a practice thing, which we see. That's quite a nice little cliche. So it's so entertaining. Marshall Teague's in there as well. Just mentioned from Roadhouse.
He was in U.S. Forces.
Special Forces, yeah.
As I said, Special Forces. Yeah.
Special Forces was, I think Special Forces came out afterwards, yeah. So Florentine made US Seals 2 in 2001. Special Forces came out in 2003, which were built on some of these ideas and then sort of added in Scott Adkins into the mix for the sort of manga. I mean, Special Forces, for the most part, doesn't have a lot of great action, except for when Scott Adkins
comes up. Scott comes into it. Yeah,
that's the real part. But, yeah, I mean, by this point, Florentine had already done Cold Harvest with Gary Daniels, which had some good action but wasn't particularly memorable. High Voltage with Shannon Lee.
Savate. So how does it pronounce? I thought it was a...
Savate.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he did Savat with Olivia Gruner, and as you say, all the Power Rangers stuff, which he was sort of was his bread and butter at that time before December. So any action film who has any action fan who hasn't seen US Seals 2 needs to rectify that immediately.
And as I said, you can find this for tips, basically. It's worth picking up. So that's the end of our show this week. Thanks to Rich and Steve for joining me.
No problem at all, sir.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.
Thank you for listening.